The old saying is, memory is a faulty crutch. Illinois State University professor Dawn McBride knows that as well as anyone. She studies memory and the creation of false memories. Let's start the conversation with how memory works in the first place. Is it unchanging, or do we reconstruct it every time?
Pretty much the second. We reconstruct it every time. Memory works such that we store each of the pieces of an experience, in fact, in different areas of our brain. And then an important part, called the hippocampus, helps us put it all back together when we want to retrieve something, recall, remember something. And sometimes those pieces come back differently. They come back not at all, or they come back changed. So, yes, it's definitely a reconstructive process each time.
Why, then, do we have people who are reputed to have eidetic memories, you know, photographic memories or perfect memories if it's not actually photographic?
Right. There's no actual scientific evidence that there is such a thing as photographic memory, in that people take pictures of things and store them in their minds. What there is evidence of is people who have the ability to use mnemonic techniques in very expert ways. So, for example, there are people who compete in memory championships where they can memorize the order of cards in, say, three decks of cards that have been randomly mixed. And they can easily tell you how they do that, which is by creating elaborate images and pathways to connect the cards to, and memorizing them that way very quickly. It's not because they're taking photographs of the cards and storing them.
And then for people who have otherwise really good memories, how is their way of accessing and reconstructing the data different from those of us who have less precise recall?
Well, it's probably not so much a matter of how they reconstruct it, it's how they store it in the first place. There are lots of ways that we can store information such that it's much more likely to be recalled later. Using, for example, imagery, connecting it with things we know, and creating things that are unusual, that are going to stand out, give us lots of cues to help us retrieve something. So encoding it in a particular way is usually the best way to remember it. And then, of course, another best way to remember it is to practice remembering it. So the more you retrieve something, the more likely you are to then retrieve it again later in the future. And the more you practice that, like a muscle, the more you work it, the better it gets.
Is that good for specific items of recall, or is it just a general tool that will enable you to get better at all recall?
Well, it's usually seen more as a specific items for recall. So if you practice retrieving something, you're going to retrieve that particular information better.
The first 10,000 numbers of pi.
Right, exactly. But the more you practice using those kinds of techniques, the more likely you are to use them without even thinking about it. The more it's like a skill that you practice, and the more you are practicing encoding information in that particular way, or getting yourself in the practice of retrieving information, say when you have some downtime, just sitting around, you want to try to remember your vocabulary words for a test, then, you know, using that time to do that, when you get in practice for that, it will help you do it more again in the future.
There's a study, actually a number of studies, that show that chess masters, given several different chess positions to look at, can reconstruct them and tell you what piece went where with a high, high degree of accuracy. You know, the average club player, not so high. But if you randomize the pieces on the board and just have a cluster of pieces that is not within a structure of a game, the recall for the chess masters drops to maybe a little better than the average club player, but not that much higher.
Right.
What's going on there?
Well, the chess masters are using their expertise in chess and knowing different configurations of the board to more easily encode the information. So they're connecting it with things that they are experts at, things that they know very well. Whereas your average chess player may not know as many board configurations, they're not as easily able to encode that information, and so they're not going to retrieve it as easily.
So it's pattern recognition.
For the most part, in that case, yes.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Dawn McBride of Illinois State University about memories. What happens when patterns aren't true? What happens when you recall something and it's not what actually happened.
Well, in most cases, you're not even aware of it. Memories change all the time without us even realizing that they've been changed. They can change quite implicitly, unconsciously, just simply because we've thought about something differently, because someone has made a suggestion to us about an experience. Maybe they're relating their perspective on an experience, and without realizing it, it can change our own memory of the experience. So most false memories are cases where people don't even know that their memory is false.
For instance?
Well, to give you a for instance, I encounter situations often in talking to my husband where he says, "You never told me you were going to have a meeting late today and be home late today." And I say, "Yes, I did. I remember explicitly telling you that." And we may talk some more and reconstruct what actually happened. And I realized I only thought about telling him that I was going to be late that day and never actually did it. And so just thinking about it created sort of an event in my mind that I then later confused with an actual event that never really happened. But until we reconstructed what actually happened together, I believed that was an actual experience I'd had. It was a false memory that I thought was real.
Do people do that sort of false reconstruction when they're storytelling and they embellish or say something that adds to the drama of the story that over time shifts the nature of the story to something highly unlikely?
Oh, certainly. Studies have been done looking at how imagination even, just imagining performing actions, imagining something happening to you can influence memory. That is actually a way that many false memories have been created, by people simply imagining that something happened. And when you're telling a story, you're often reimagining the event, reimagining what occurred. And if you embellish, you are imagining those embellishments, and they can easily become part of your memory for the experience.
Now, you study something called the D. Serodiger-McDermott paradigm, or DRM, about false memory. Tell us how that works and what you're working on.
Mm-hmm. The DRM method is a very simple experimental technique to create very basic and benign false memories in research subjects. What we do is present lists of items that are thematically related to a word that is never shown or spoken to the participants. So, for example, if we present items like bed, slumber, blanket, dream, later, when we ask subjects to recall or recognize items that we've presented to them, with high frequency, they'll think they have heard or seen the word sleep, because it's very much thematically related to those items. But these are very benign false memories. It doesn't create any sort of bad experiences for our participants. But it does allow us to then change the way we create those lists, change the way they're presented, so that we can better understand how false memories are created through the way that our memory works on a natural, everyday basis.
If memory is a shaky set of ground, a swampy ground, how can we be sure of our memory enough to rely upon it?
Well, in most cases, our memory does work reasonably well. In fact, false memories are often not necessarily thought just of as memory errors, but a byproduct of our memories trying to help us. So if you think about the way that the DRM method I just described creates false memories by having us think that a word that's related to something we've already experienced was also experienced, that's actually our memory helping fill in perhaps pieces of missing items. If sleep had actually been shown and we didn't have a recollective experience of it, just simply filling in pieces of things that are related to what we did experience and we do recollect can actually help increase the accuracy of our memory. So it's sort of two sides of the same coin. Our memory is kind of trying to help us by filling in pieces of things that may not be complete in our memories based on how we know the world works, but also sometimes does that to excess and fills in pieces that are just not quite accurate. So in most cases, I think the core of our memory is correct. It's just that we sometimes get some details incorrect. And if we're careful not to engage in some of the techniques like too much fantasy and imagination, we will probably not end up with too many experiences of memories that never actually happened.
It's not always benign, though. Sometimes false memories that are induced can be a real problem.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why the research has sort of investigated some of those techniques that we're concerned about might actually create those. So, for example, therapists using imagination and guided imagery to help people try to remember traumatic experiences. Well, that can be dangerous sometimes if, in fact, it leads to the creation of a false memory that is traumatic for that client. That's why the research is important, to better understand exactly which of those techniques is problematic in terms of more likely to create false memories that are not benign for individuals.
So what's a problematic technique then?
Well, some of the things that I've been mentioning, asking if a therapist, for example, believes that someone is highly anxious because perhaps of a repressed memory from their childhood, asking them to simply imagine bad things that could have happened to them. I'm not a therapist, so I don't know exactly how those techniques work, but those kinds of things have been investigated in research to show that that sort of imagination technique can sometimes create false memories. And there have been cases where individuals have accused family members and other close friends of abuse from their childhood and so forth that have turned out to be false.
How about eyewitness testimony in criminal cases?
Mm-hmm. That's actually a very active area of research these days. Eyewitness memory is not perfect. And in fact, in some cases, even when eyewitnesses are quite confident in their memory is not accurate. Confidence is not always the best predictor of memory accuracy. In the last couple of decades, research has really advanced in that area. Questioning techniques of individuals who are witnesses or victims of crimes has slowly been changing. Officers are now aware, detectives are now aware of how suggestive questioning can change the answers they get from potential witnesses. And I think slowly some changes are being made that are helping prevent the kinds of false memories that might wrongfully convict someone of a crime.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about memories with Dawn McBride of Illinois State University. The amount of attention that a person is paying to a specific situation that may be up for later recall, say in a crime, how much does that affect what's going on in memory formation?
Well, it certainly can affect what is encoded. There are, for example, results from research showing that if one pays most attention to, say, a weapon, if they're a witness to a crime, then they might miss other details. In other cases, if you are paying close attention to all of the details, then you might actually improve your memory. So attention can both help and hinder depending on how it's used in a situation.
When someone is being called on to recall or to give a witness statement immediately afterwards, is that more reliable or less reliable than when they're called on to testify in court?
Well, you've got some things working for and some things working against initially. I don't know that there's a good set answer to that. I think it depends on how traumatized the person is. So the more traumatized they are, the more time might help their memory fill in gaps that the trauma is sort of blocking. But in other cases, if the person has experienced something that they have not been traumatized by, the short delay is actually going to help memory accuracy because, forgetting obviously takes place pretty quickly. And if you wait too long, some of those details might be lost before they are able to go over what happened and recollect it to strengthen those memories. So it kind of depends on, I think, the situation that the person's in that's being questioned and asked to remember.
Is traumatic memory different from ordinary memory?
Some research has shown that it is. That's not specifically my area of expertise, but emotion certainly does influence our memories. Positive emotions, negative emotions can both influence memory in different ways. Some research has shown, for example, that you're more likely to have false memories in some of the simple paradigms, experimental paradigms that have been used if you're in a positive mood than if you're in a negative mood.
Why?
Well, because when you're in a negative mood, you're more likely to focus on details. And if you focus on the details, you're more likely to remember, for example, exactly which words were presented to you in, say, the DRM paradigm and be able to reject sleep as an item that was presented. But if you're in a positive mood, you're more likely to be making sort of relational or notice relations between items, between information. And so you're more likely to think, oh, well, sleep's related to those items, so it must be one that I saw on the list. And that's generally what the research has shown.
So the old joke about I'm not a pessimist, I'm a realist, it has some truth to it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Maybe you can help me here. Over the last couple of years, my schedule has gotten so busy, and maybe I'm just older than I used to be, but I am having more trouble and more fear of not remembering my to-do list, the things I have on a daily basis. Now, I've compensated with computer software, but I still worry more than I used to, and a lot of the time, my computer software gives me surprises where it did not seem to do that, 10 years ago. What's going on there?
Well, there are a couple of things. What you're talking about here is your prospective memory, so trying to remember things you need to do in the future. And the computer programs will help, the schedules, the post-it notes, all of those kinds of things will help. As we get older, we do tend to fear more that those kinds of things are going to fail us. That's the most common memory failure reported by older adults. And in fact, the busier we are, the more likely we are to miss some of those things we need to remember to do. But the good news is that a lot of the research shows that the older we get, the better we get at constructing our environments to help us remember. So in fact, when older adults are asked to do tasks in research where they have to remember to do something in the future, like mail a postcard or call a researcher or send a text message, they actually tend to do better than younger adults, partly because they are able to set up their environment so that they remember. They're more motivated sometimes to do those kinds of tasks. They tend to show pretty good abilities in that, even though if you ask them, they'll say, I tend to be pretty bad at those kinds of things, in their own sort of ideas of their memory.
Dawn McBride is a professor at Illinois State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.